Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Dancing in the streets, U.S. officials have been muted in their response, and the father of one of his victims says he wishes Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had not been killed. We have reaction from around the world to the death of the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Two 500-pound bombs killed Zarqawi and several aides in a safe house north of Baghdad early today. But U.S. military officials say he was ultimately brought down by tips from Iraqi civilians and turncoat leaders of Zarqawi's own network. We'll have more on the future of Zarqawi's insurgency, and in a moment we'll speak with Michael Berg, the father of Nicholas Berg, who U.S. officials say was beheaded 2 years ago by Zarqawi himself. But first, we turn to Baghdad, to Chicago Tribune reporter Liz Sly. And Liz, I understand you were on your way to the airport and turned around when you heard the news. How are Iraqis reacting?
Well, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis are very happy about this. Of course, nobody has liked the suicide bombings that have made life so miserable here. But I think you'll find that Sunnis are a little bit more cautious in their response to this because they feel that the militias who have been targeting Sunnis are a bigger threat to the country, and this focus on Zarqawi doesn't suit them quite so well.
And we spoke with you yesterday, and these are the Shia, largely Shia-backed militias that are allegedly targeting the Sunnis. Well, to start off his news conference today, Major General William Caldwell showed a huge photograph of the dead Zarqawi's face. It was quite a beginning to an extraordinary news conference. Can you briefly describe the events leading up to Zarqawi's arrest? Because we understand this was an intense manhunt that began 2 weeks ago.
Well, yes, General Caldwell actually said it began about a month and a half ago. Over the past few weeks, they've captured quite a series of about 8 or 9 different al-Qaeda leaders. And he didn't go into too many details, but certainly the implication was that some of them had been talking about Zarqawi. He also suggested there was an informant inside al-Qaeda who had led them to where Zarqawi was staying at that time.
And we understand only 6 days ago, Zarqawi released an audio tape on the Internet in which he rallied Sunnis to kill Shia Muslims in Iraq. How much did statements like that, do you think, play into his demise?
Sorry, how much did statements like that?
You know, the divisiveness, the sectarian violence that he was behind, how much did that actually, you know, backfire on him perhaps?
Well, in some ways it has backfired on him. First of all, he's succeeded, if you like. I mean, he's already succeeded. The strife is there. The sectarian tensions are there. The Shiites put up for a long time with all these suicide bombings, but it's clear that they have started taking revenge over the past year. And so, if you like, Zarqawi has already won. He's sown the seeds of sectarianism in this country, and it's going to be very hard to stamp that out quickly. But on the other hand, we've certainly had a lot of indications from the insurgency, from their website, from their statements in recent months that not all insurgents were happy with this extreme emphasis that Zarqawi was placing on targeting fellow Shiite Muslims and targeting civilians and trying to stir up strife here. Some insurgents felt that that was giving the insurgency a bad name and perhaps losing them support among some members of the mostly Sunni community. And it's not out of the question that, you know, this might have contributed to Zarqawi's betrayal. And in recent months, he had been sidelined by some members of the insurgency as well. They had announced that he was no longer the head of the insurgency, but was a member of a Mujahideen council that would be headed by an Iraqi. That was announced back in January.
Yeah. Liz Sly is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. She's speaking to us from Baghdad on reaction there today to the news of al-Zarqawi's death. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And later in the program, we'll talk to a terrorism expert about Zarqawi's impact outside of Iraq. But first, at a NATO meeting today in Belgium, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said a terrorist mastermind is now gone.
I think arguably over the last several years, no single person on this planet has had the blood of more innocent men, women, and children on his hands than Zarqawi. He personified the dark, sadistic, and medieval vision of the future of beheadings and suicide bombings and indiscriminate killings.
Well, one of the deaths Zarqawi is believed to be responsible for is the beheading of 26-year-old American contractor Nicholas Berg back in 2004. And joining us now, Nick's father, Michael Berg. Michael, how are you doing today?
Just physically, I'm in pain. I'm just a tightness in my gut. My friend here is just telling me to breathe, and I don't think I've done that for the last 4 hours, really, since about 4:30 this morning when the phone first rang.
What happens when you hear the name al-Zarqawi? I mean, it has such a different meaning for you than anyone.
Well, when I hear the name Zarqawi, what comes to my mind right away is a cycle of revenge. A cycle of revenge. I don't know who started it. It was probably started back in the days of the cavemen. But people like Zarqawi and George Bush are still acting like cavemen and still trying to solve problems that could be solved diplomatically through violence. Mm-hmm. And so when I think of Zarqawi, I think of Bush, and I think of this endless cycle of revenge that at least I've put a stop to it on my end.
Let's remind people, we've spoken before, and you've been outspoken about this. In fact, in 2004, you wrote, "Even more than those murderers who took my son's life, I can't stand those who sit and make policies to end lives and break the lives of the still living." You know, you took a lot of criticism then, and I'm guessing still today, for blaming Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush as much as the hand that killed your son.
Well, you know, Donald Rumsfeld on a press interview just used the word medieval to describe Zarqawi. And Donald Rumsfeld said that he took responsibility for the events that took place in the Abu Ghraib prison. And I think that they're pretty medieval, and they are the reason that was given on that videotape for my son's death. It was retaliation for the medieval acts of Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Alberto Gonzalez.
You also wrote at that time, I'm sure that the one, and I'm so sorry, by the way, to be speaking back these words, because I can't imagine how you're feeling today, but you wrote, "I'm sure that the one who wielded the knife felt Nick's breath on his hand."
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
And knew that he had a real human being there. You, in those words, are talking about al-Zarqawi.
Right. That's right. And I believe that there is a human being there, and that through reconciliation and restorative justice, that human being could be brought out in him.
Michael Berg, what are you saying? Are you saying that you wish that Zarqawi had not been killed?
I am saying that any man's death diminishes me, in the words of John Donne. Yes, I wish he had not been killed. I wish I had had the opportunity to have a reconciliation with him. I wish I could have sat down with him instead of the empty chair that I did sit down with and have a conversation asking him to stop killing people, to make restitution to those that he can, and to participate in some restorative activity, like maybe working the rest of his life in a hospital where children have had limbs removed, so that he can learn deep in his heart the sanctity of the human body.
I understand that Nick was a supporter of the war in Iraq, and he was a supporter of George Bush, despite you come to your feelings after decades of practice. And your son, you know, disagreed with you.
I taught him how to think. I didn't teach him what to think.
What do you think he might think today?
Well, you know, way back when I would come home from an anti-war rally, Nick would say to me, "Dad, you know, you and I disagree about this war, but I admire you and respect you for standing up for what you think is right." I don't know how Nick would feel about Zarqawi's death. I know that Nick wouldn't have taken Zarqawi's life himself.
I understand that people are responding to you, even today on this day, being kind of critical of these thoughts. Am I hearing that?
Yeah, you know, what I say to people who are critical of my saying revenge is wrong is that revenge justifies revenge. And were I to say that I wanted revenge on Zarqawi, which I never said. In fact, I told the FBI not to kill him. I actually told the FBI when they interviewed me, trying to get leads on where he might be through articles of clothing and whatnot that Nick might have had on him. I said to them, don't kill him. And the reason why I say that is that I don't want to justify what Zarqawi did to my son. And if you say that it's okay for me to be happy that Zarqawi is dead, that's saying it's okay for revenge to exist. And revenge is what got my son killed. Revenge is what killed my son. How can I be happy on a day when revenge is at a high point?
But this is a man who, Zarqawi, has been behind so many other killings, behind the sectarian violence. Isn't there a point where, to save other lives, a life might have to be taken?
I don't believe that. I believe that there are some absolutes in this world, and that one absolute is that nobody has the right to take another life.
Michael Berg, even if you were in that horrible room and you could have stopped that hand with that knife that day, you wouldn't have done it?
I would have stopped it if I could. I would have thrown myself in front of it, but I would not take another person's life.
Michael Berg, I so appreciate your time. And again, I'm sorry for the thoughts that must be coming back to you on this day.
Thank you.
Well, we turn now to Jessica Stern, a terrorism expert at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, author of Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. Jessica, first of all, your thoughts on the thoughts of Michael Berg, father of Nick Berg, allegedly beheaded by Zarqawi.
Well, it was one of the most moving interviews that I've ever heard. He's a very impressive human being. I don't think there are many fathers who could find it within themselves to come out against revenge when their son had been killed that way. But the important thing to me is that this was not an act of revenge. This was a man who needed to be removed from the battlefield. This is a man who was going after civilians, who was a bane not just to the U.S. military but to the Iraqi people. We have to think about the people that he was killing and the people that he was inspiring to kill others through his horrific acts of violence.
We're going to take a break in about a minute, and we're going to bring you back afterwards. But how important is it to the insurgency in Iraq that he has been removed?
I think it's extremely important. It doesn't mean that the insurgency will end, but I think it is very important, and we should not confuse removing a vicious killer from the battlefield with revenge.
And oddly, you're saying that the horrific video of Michael Berg's son, Nick Berg, being killed was part of what made Zarqawi such a powerful leader.
Yes, it's what made him unique. He will go down in history, I believe, as having started something new.
Which is the use of the Internet.
Yes.
That's Jessica Stern, terrorism expert at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, also author of Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. We're going to speak much more with Jessica Stern about Zarqawi's legacy, if you will. We're also going to check in with Rami Khoury in the region, in Lebanon, actually. How are Iraqis, how are Arabs, how is the whole region reacting to the news today of the killing of al-Zarqawi? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. The sounds of Iraqi soldiers celebrating the news that al-Qaeda and Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is dead. There are also scenes of Iraqi police dancing in the streets of Baghdad. And we're back with Jessica Stern, a terrorism expert at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and also author Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill, is one of her works. We're also joined now by Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Lebanon. And Rami, I want to start with you. We heard the sounds from the streets of Baghdad. What's the reaction in other parts of the Arab world that you're hearing?
Well, from what I've been hearing in the media and reading and just talking to people here in Beirut, I think there's a more nuanced reaction here than there is in the United States. I think people here generally in the Arab world are separating several strands that really should be looked at separately. One is the role of Zarqawi himself in Iraq, as representing the global movement of al-Qaeda and those kind of jihadi Salafist terrorists who see themselves fighting a global war. The second one is the indigenous Iraqi resistance and insurgency against the American British-led military occupation and remaking of the country. Those two things have to be separated quite distinctly, and I think what people here are saying is that I think most people are happy that his kind of barbarism has been put to an end, at least at his hand, that he's not around to do this kind of killing of children and women and innocent civilians. At the same time, I think there is widespread feeling that the violence against the American British-led occupation will probably continue because that is seen to be a nationalist resistance movement rather than a global terrorist one. And the key in the final analysis is whether the Iraqi government can develop the political legitimacy and security credibility to bring this kind of terrorism to an end.
Well, in fact, today the Iraqi government did name two new positions in the government. Defense, Interior, and National Security Ministers were sworn in. But, Ramiz, you know, I've got Jessica Stern here, and I'm just wondering about that, Jessica. Ramiz says that, of course, the insurgency is not just one from Zarqawi. There was a nationalist insurgency as well. And you were just mentioning that Zarqawi became a master at using the Internet. Isn't it true that he may be gone, but this that he seeded, this use of the Internet, lives on?
Yes, I think it is true that in a way he got what he set out to achieve. The sectarian tensions are now at a boiling point, as he hoped, as we heard from one of the earlier experts. But in addition, he has changed the world of terrorism. He is a master marketeer, making bin Laden, in fact, look a bit inept, the way he was able to use the Internet. You know, I've heard of young Islamists getting married, violent Islamists getting married, and on their wedding night, watching the videos of the beheading in order to prepare themselves for the jihad. I mean, this is just such a horrific thing. And while, again, I greatly admire Michael Berg's equanimity, at the same time, I've talked to a lot of terrorists, and most of them you think are manipulated by evil people. But once in a while you run into someone who actually feels like you really feel you're in the presence of evil, and it's hard to describe. I mean, one has a kind of physical revulsion. Mm. And I think it is quite likely that Zarqawi is, in fact, a man who was evil. Not that he was all evil, but that he was more evil than most.
We're going to be speaking with his biographer in a moment who has the same viewpoint. And Rami Khoury, you were mentioning that there were many reasons for people in other countries to dislike them. One of them has to be last November's triple bombing in Amman, Jordan. It killed 60 people, mostly Sunni Muslims. Zarqawi was said to be behind that attack, and it outraged Jordanians.
Well, absolutely. And I happened to be in Amman 2 days ago, and I was actually talking to people in the security services, and they see terrorism as their number one threat right now on a regional basis, and links with the global terrorist movements. And Zarqawi, I think, represents a new phenomenon in the world of terrorism, is that he has been able to combine an indigenous resistance to foreign military occupation in Iraq with a regional and a global jihadi movement, which is run by very violent and clearly very evil people in most cases when they're going around killing innocent people all over the world. But the reality is that these people, in fact, not only expect to die, but in some ways covet death, and the martyrdom is something that is going to be used as a recruiting and a mobilizing tool. They're also extremely adept at surviving these kinds of attacks. And if you go back over the last 3 or 4 years, the United States has been having, you know, playing cards and posters full of these guys that they want to catch, the Qaeda and the people in Iraq. And the more they catch of these people, the higher is the rate of the attacks against them in Iraq. So there's an inverse relationship between killing individual leaders and the number of attacks against Americans and Iraqis. So I think there's a more than a mathematical formula here in terms of catching bad guys and killing them. There is a widespread violence problem in Iraq and throughout the region and the world, which is related to causes other than the evil of individual killers. And I think this is the bigger problem in Iraq, with the political issue, the legitimacy issue, social and economic issues, foreign occupation. Until we grapple with all of those together, we are never going to get out of this terrible cycle of death.
Jessica Stern, last thought from you. There are a lot of names floating already as to who might have be replacing al-Zarqawi. Do you think it matters?
Well, I think Rami is absolutely right to focus on that this is a nationalist insurgency against a foreign occupation. And certainly there will be leaders who will emerge to run that insurgency. But there will be no immediate replacement for Zarqawi, who has a unique legacy related, I think, to the evil that we're talking about and his use of the internet. He has a legacy that will remain with us forever.
But as we've learned, anyone can use the internet. They were given the idea from him, maybe, but anyone can use it. That's Jessica Stern, a terrorism expert at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, also author of Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Lebanon, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Jessica, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Still to come, we're going to speak with a biographer of Zarqawi about who just might be waiting in the wings. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program
killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the most wanted terrorist in Iraq, the man who waged a violent campaign of beheadings and suicide bombings as leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi and several aides were killed Wednesday night in Iraq when U.S. warplanes dropped 500-pound bombs on their safe house 30 miles outside of Baghdad. U.S. military officials say intelligence from some of Zarqawi's people led U.S. forces to Zarqawi as he was meeting with his associates. U.S. military spokesperson Major General William Caldwell says they had no doubt that Zarqawi was in the safe house and that he was killed in the raid. Caldwell said as proof they have Zarqawi's fingerprints and are conducting a DNA analysis. Caldwell also provided photographs of the dead terrorist.
The pictures we provided to you were obviously, we had wiped off a lot of the blood and other debris because there was not a need to betray it in any kind of dehumanizing his body. The intent was to show you that he, in fact, had died.
Zarqawi is believed to have beheaded two Americans, Eugene Armstrong from Hillsdale, Michigan, and Nicholas Berg from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Earlier today, we spoke with Nicholas Berg's father, Michael, who did not want Zarqawi to be killed.
Yes, I wish he had not been killed. I wish I had had the opportunity to have a reconciliation with him. I wish I could have sat down with him instead of the empty chair that I did sit down with and have a conversation asking him to stop killing people, to make restitution to those that he can, and to participate in some restorative activity, like maybe working the rest of his life in a hospital where children have had limbs removed, so that he can learn and deepen his heart the sanctity of the human body.
That's Michael Berg of Pennsylvania reacting to today's news that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in Iraq in a U.S. bombing attack. So who was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and what impact will his death have on al-Qaeda in Iraq and across the rest of the world? Jean-Charles Brissard wrote the book Zarqawi, The New Face of al-Qaeda. He joins us on the line from Switzerland. And first of all, your reaction when you heard the news that al-Zarqawi had been killed?
I was not surprised because we knew for years that Zarqawi was vulnerable, that contrary to bin Laden, who came from the from a cave in Pakistan or Afghanistan, record audio or video messages, Zarqawi had to be on the ground. He was a military chief for al-Qaeda, and for this reason, he had to be with his soldiers, basically, on the ground in Iraq. So we knew for years that he could be killed any time.
Do you think there was something in the way he was functioning that also signaled his demise?
What I think is the extreme violence he used in his operation, and especially at the beginning of the U.S. offensive in Afghanistan was part of his strategy to build his statute of leader of the most important and the most extremist group in Iraq. And in that regard, he mainly succeeded in building a group that became the most important, the group that received the most funding and the most arms and also soldiers from outside Iraq for the insurgency. So this strategy turned to be a victory for his group. Yeah.
But you've also said that he in fact eclipsed Osama bin Laden, and that Al Qaeda was not involved in Iraq, didn't want to be at all involved in Iraq. In the past, you note there was a fatwa issued from Osama bin Laden against Saddam Hussein, asking for the killing of Saddam Hussein. So how was he viewed by Osama bin Laden's people as he grew in stature in Iraq?
There's always been, you're right, a conflict between Zarqawi and al-Qaeda for years, because he was from Jordan, because he was imprisoned in this country, and that he was viewed by several high-ranking members of al-Qaeda as someone who could have been used by the Jordanian intelligence. And then came Iraq, and his strategy of the chaos, basically targeting the Shia, but also the United States and other communities, turned to be something that al-Qaeda opposed. But finally, he succeeded. That's the point. I mean, al-Qaeda had to revise his judgment and his strategy and agree that Zarqawi was the one who was considered as a symbol, as the main figure of the insurgency in this country, and to approve his strategy.
Do you have any sense of how he was discovered? Do you think... We hear that villagers, you know, people who lived in the area were increasingly upset with the sectarian violence that he was fomenting. Do you think his own people perhaps even turned on him?
The political situation and progressive stabilization in Iraq played against him. That's true, and that's why he had to appear in this video some weeks ago to show that he was still there and still alive and still in charge.
Was that the somewhat pathetic video of him trying to shoot a gun and
right,
not being able to?
That's right.
And one of his assistants in trying to help him shoot the gun burned his hand.
Exactly.
You have written extensively about al-Zarqawi, and you call him a loser. You say that, you know, from a young person, he didn't come from necessarily a poor background. His father worked for the city, that they lived in. But he just, there was something, it wasn't his background, it wasn't religion that was his driving force as much as it was his personality. He sounds like a thug.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. Religion and especially the jihad came to him very late, and he was used by him to become someone and to continue his violence. He was someone really violent, caught and indicted for various crimes or various things in his city of Zarqa, but he was a loser, yeah.
In fact, one of his crimes, he was alleged to have committed a rape at one point.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He was questioned for it.
What does al-Zarqawi's death mean for Osama bin Laden?
It doesn't mean much for al-Qaeda in Iraq, but it means a lot for al-Qaeda globally, because Zarqawi was important not only in Iraq but also outside Iraq. As you know, the police all over the world have dismantled a lot of recruiting cells for Iraq, including in Europe, in North Africa, and in Canada and elsewhere. And these people were attracted mostly by the figure of Zarqawi.
Does this mean that you know, exporting of violence outside of Iraq, does this mean that this will, his death will perhaps stop that or slow it down?
Yes, in that regard, probably al-Qaeda will have to redefine its strategy and to find new ways to attract new recruits to the jihad movement they have created.
Jean-Charles Brissard, the author of Zarqawi, The New Face of al-Qaeda. He spoke to us from Switzerland. Well, it seems as if you just can't get away from the topic of terrorism today. Still to come, we'll speak with author Julia Glass, a main character in her new novel, 9/11. You're listening to Here and Now. And now we turn to sports. Also tinged with terrorism, security officials in Germany are gearing up for the beginning of the World Cup tomorrow. Among measures that will be taken, NATO planes will be patrolling Germany's skies. Soldiers will be standing by with radiation and chemical detection equipment. Stadium evacuation drills have been rehearsed. And after that, oh yes, games will be played. Here to talk about the World Cup and other news from the world of sports, Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And we've read that officials are concerned with terrorism, but who hooliganism, you know, is also a big issue in soccer. Violent fans, and a lot of talk leading up to this about racism directed at black players. English fans being warned not to make references to World War II, which apparently they love to do. This seems like, is there more for officials to be worried about at this event than at previous World Cups?
Well, I'm not sure there's more to be worried about, except that there seems to be more to be worried about everywhere, or people seem to believe that there's more to be worried about everywhere. The English fans, of course, misbehave most spectacularly when England plays Germany, at which point they sometimes sing a song, the lyric of which is, "Stand up if you won the war." And there is a certain level of discomfort there, without any doubt. But thousands of known hooligans in England have had their passports confiscated by the local constabulary, and they won't be traveling anywhere. They won't be going to Germany. So I'm not real concerned about that part of it. The racism is unhappily a presence in soccer as it is in the world in general, and it's been very highly publicized lately, especially in Spain, where black players have been the object of insults by a small number of fans.
We understand there's also concerns about corruption. Today's New York Times reports that soccer officials are making players and coaches sign pledges that they and their families won't bet on games.
Mm-hmm. This is unhappily one of the consequences partly of our technology. The Internet has made gambling easier, and there are syndicates all over the world that are involved with taking bets from fans on the World Cup. And there have been, of course, some scandals in Italy recently about which referees have been assigned to which matches. And, of course, in a situation such as prevails in Italy and around the rest of the world where relegation happens, if a team loses, there's a huge amount of money at stake if they go from Division One to Division Two, and so there has been some match fixing, apparently.
Right. Well, and then they will actually play a game. What do you think we should keep an eye on? Seamus Malin of ESPN early this week said, you know, Brazil, mm-hmm. but then Argentina, the Netherlands, maybe a team from Africa. What do you think?
Well, I think people have to pay attention to the home team, Germany, because although Germany hasn't played as brilliantly as they might have in the run-up to the World Cup, the history of the World Cup has given a tremendous advantage to the team playing at home, and you can't overlook that. And I think it's only fair to mention the U.S. team. Everybody involved with the U.S. team has said that it's the strongest team the U.S. has ever sent. And, of course, 4 years ago at the World Cup in 2002, the U.S. played very well against Germany. Many people thought they deserved to win that game and get all the way to the semifinals. But even reaching the quarters was a terrific achievement. So we'll see how well they do.
Okay, quick touchdown on basketball. The NBA Finals begin tonight. The Dallas Mavericks take on the Miami Heat in Dallas. You've been finding the playoffs exciting to watch. What should we be looking for?
Well, there will be this slight diversion of the World Cup from now on, so it'll be a little harder to pay attention to the NBA playoffs. I'm still not sure how a team with Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade loses, although I love watching Dallas. They're my favorite team to watch because they have so many different ways to score. Should be a great series.
And just a couple seconds, we want to talk about the French Open tennis tournament. We're not going to talk about the women. They're playing. It'll be televised tonight. But everyone's hoping in the men's finals to see number one seeded Roger Federer against last year's champion, number two seed Rafael Nadal. Why can't Federer win the French? He has never done so.
Maybe because nobody plays as they would like to on that surface, because it's unusual and they don't see it anywhere else. I can't come up with any other explanation, because it seems to me I'm dumb enough to think a great tennis player on grass and a fast surface would be great on clay as well. I don't get it.
But it gets him every time. Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. He'll be talking World Cup, NBA, much more from the world of sports this weekend. Don't miss his show. Bill, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Thank you. And here's an update on the major news story of the day, the death of al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, killed by U.S. airstrikes north of Baghdad today. President Bush called Zarqawi's death a severe blow to al-Qaeda and a decisive victory in the U.S.-led war against terrorism. British Prime Minister Tony Blair agreed with that assessment, though he warned that violence will continue in Iraq, and leaders from allied nations such as Italy, Poland, and Australia praised the development. The news prompted Iraqis in Shiite neighborhoods to dance in the streets, but a former close aide to Osama bin Laden said that Zarqawi's death would not weaken the jihad in Iraq, that it would instead spark retaliatory attacks by his successors. And the Palestinian foreign minister said Zarqawi's death was only a minor loss to the anti-U.S. resistance movement. Well, terrorism can even touch and shape the world of fiction as we know. Case in point, author Julia Glass. She stunned the literary world when her first novel, Three Junes, won the prestigious National Book Award back in 2002. In her second novel, The Whole World Over, 9/11 makes an appearance. The book opens in New York City with Greenie, a pastry chef who's feeling frustrated in her marriage to Alan, a psychologist who's in the throes of a midlife crisis. Greenie decides to take a job as a chef with the governor of New Mexico, a decision that will have a ripple effect not only on her marriage and on with her son, but on her circle of friends back in New York in the months to come, which also happened to be the months leading up to the attacks on the World Trade Center. Recently, Julia Glass was in our studios to talk about The Whole World Over.
With all the pressure and the excitement hanging over me of the success of Three Junes, the one thing I didn't want to do was to write the first book over again. And I gave myself a conscious challenge. I decided that I would write from the point of view of a character who is a basically happy person. And not only that, but someone who is hugely confident about the decisions that she's made so far in her life and basically is comfortable in her place.
Well, that's who I thought Greenie was. You know, one of those women who seems to really know who she is. She's happy in her life. And then boom, 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 you know, a series of things happen to upset that happiness. And I'm just wondering, you know, how much this was a part of you maybe addressing your life. I've read in some of your essays you had a wonderful childhood, leafy, historic towns, loving parents, and then boom, 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 you know, things in your life as well. Is there a correlation there?
You know, that's a very good question, Robin, because I'll bet there's some truth there, but I certainly was not conscious of it when I was beginning this book. I will say that I was writing about how many of the assumptions that we hold when we're young, that romantic love and the creation of a family, will all really fall into place for us. Well, of course, it's not like that. So it's interesting that I would, to write a book like that, choose a character who is someone who is just the tiniest bit glib about, because things have come easily to her. And I wonder if, having come to a stage in my life where I could look back and realize that the childhood and adolescence that I had, however angst-filled they might have been in very literary ways, were really so easy compared with what I would face later on. I mean, I had a really, really tough time in my 30s and early 40s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just turned 50 and my life has never been better. But I've come to this point over quite the roller coaster.
Right. And we just should say the roller coaster included stops at divorce, cancer, and a beloved sister committing suicide.
Yes, which, and all within a period of a year.
Right. Well, back to your character, Greenie. As we said, she's in New York City. She's working in her catering business, has no idea that one of the things down the road for her is 9/11. Now, you were also literally down the road from 9/11 when it happened. We understand you could see it from your home?
Yes, I had just taken my five-year-old to, you know, it was his first week of kindergarten, and we had a new routine. And I was pleased that for the first day we were actually on time in that first week. And I walked out to the corner of 6th Avenue and I saw people staring up and gasping. It was the strangest thing to see these people. And then I came onto the avenue and the first plane had just struck the North Tower. Mm. But I'd like to say something else, which is that I had started this book in early 2001. And by September of 2001, I had written close to 100 pages of this book already. And I knew that it was going to take place in 2000 and 2001. So it would have been extremely disingenuous of me to write around it in any way, given the book that I had begun.
Because why? Are the characters different before the 9/11 event? Because it's several pages before you get to it.
I think it refocuses people, and it also puts people in places at moments that force them to make decisions they weren't prepared to make. Mm. I felt that the honest thing for me to do was to have 9/11 or the events of that day. I also find it hard calling it 9/11 when I think of my own experience of it, but that the events of that day would change the characters' lives in ways similar to the way in which it has changed mine, which is to say that I felt day-to-day life was changed a great deal, and the way that I thought about being a parent was very different. Mm-hmm. The way I thought about being a citizen of the place I lived was very different. And so those are the kinds of things that change.
The characters in the book you mentioned, Greenie, her husband Alan, their child. There's also Walter, Greenie's gay friend. Saga, a brain-damaged young woman who takes care of animals. We should say Fennel McLeod, who's a gay bookshop owner, a character in Three Junes, makes a reappearance here. It's a small role, but there he is, that connective tissue. What are you saying about all these different people and how they come together through Greenie's life?
Well, I have an extremely complex social life of my own, and I think it's impossible for me to write a book that doesn't have a great web of deeply intertwined lives, as this book does. I also wanted to convey the way in which a very, very large place can feel like a very, very small place. And this book, more than Three Junes, really hovers around a very small part of New York. There is, of course, quite a bit of the book that takes place in New Mexico and in some other locales. But this is really, if anything, I think it's a New York City novel.
Right.
And having somewhat sadly left New York myself since finishing this book, I almost see it as my love letter to New York City.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because another thing that I read was that after the Three Junes, people think, wow, she got a National Book Award for Three Junes. She must be living in a penthouse, and she owns that city. Well, in fact, you couldn't even, afford an apartment large enough for you.
That's absolutely true. I have two small children, and we were living I live with their father and these two little boys in a one-bedroom apartment in one of the most coveted neighborhoods, the West Village, in which this book takes place. But we were like a submarine crew, and we really, even with the success of Three Junes, we couldn't figure out how to do it, at least in a neighborhood with good public schools, which was a priority to
me. I was going to ask, in your book, Greenie's son sleeps behind a wall of books, is it?
Yes.
So that it creates Did any of your little boys sleep behind a wall of books? Because that was a great idea.
Yes, actually, I designed a tiny room in our square living room in which the walls were bookcases with a sliding door. And of course, that solved two problems: housing my new baby when I had my first son and then later my second son, and also all my never-ending and ever-growing collection of books, which were beginning to occupy the apartment in stacks all over the floor.
Well, you've got a new book to put in the bookcase. It's called The Whole World Over. We're talking to author Julia Glass about a new book which deals with the lives and loves of a circle of family and friends just before and shortly after September 11th, 2001. Julia, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.